Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Here you'll find real-life case studies of school owners just like you who have applied our proven successful business and marketing principles to their school and are creating the business of their dreams as a result.
Well, hello there. This is Stephen Oliver, CEO of the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. I'm delighted to be joined by longtime NAPM Inner Circle member, Eric Sabarge. Eric, welcome to our conversation today.
Thank you, Master Oliver. Glad to be here.
So, Eric, you have a very unique school, and for certainly a lot of the members, a little bit of a unique format and structure. So, let's start by just giving everybody a little bit of your martial arts background and how you came to be where you're at now.
Okay. As far as the martial arts go, I began about 35 years ago. I did a few years of Japanese martial arts and then switched over to Chinese martial arts, which I've done for the last 30-some-odd years, and focused primarily on Shaolin Kung Fu, Swai Jiao, which is the Chinese wrestling and grappling. And my most popular program is the Tai Chi program. So we do a traditional Tai Chi where we teach both the health aspects and the self-defense aspects, which most people nowadays in Tai Chi are just teaching it for health and well-being, and rightly so, because I think that's what more people need compared to self-defense. But for those who want Tai Chi as a self-defense art, that's kind of something we specialize in as well. And I opened my school. We just had our 15th anniversary. I've been teaching for about 20 years, but originally just teaching a few students in the park. And then as it grew, we rented some space in the school, kind of has grown from there.
What were you doing before you opened the school?
I had sort of a variety of different career steps. I worked in publishing management for several years. I ran a construction company for several years. And then I was a public school teacher for 4 years before I opened the school.
It doesn't sound like there's any relationship to any of those three things.
Other than, with the exception of the public school teaching, for all the others, marketing and sales skills were essential, and that's something that a lot of people overlook, you know, the importance of good persuasion skills. So I think it has lent itself to opening and running the martial arts school successfully, is realizing that every day we're persuading people to try to do something good for themselves. So those skills, while they seem kind of disparate, they really do tie in sort of indirect way.
Good point, good point. And you know, that leads back to one of the things that I've always advocated for staff training, and I know that we've always done a lot of sales training and communication skills training with all the instructors, and the blowback often comes, or the question comes, well, I'm a teacher, why do I need persuasion skills? But mm-hmm. To emphasize what you just said, all we're doing all day long is convincing people to continue to train harder, to be more consistent in their training, to train longer, to be more dedicated to this as a lifestyle. That's probably the most important piece of persuasion that we have in our repertoire. Talk a little bit more about that, because it's a good point you make early on here that a lot of people miss.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, even as a public school teacher, it's one thing to just disseminate information, but especially when you have kids who don't want to be in the classroom, as is often the case with public school, really your job is to be a motivator and persuader more than anything. So we're kind of fortunate with our martial arts schools that, you know, the majority of our students really want to be there and want to be learning. But even every day, you've probably heard it said that every day the student makes the decision whether they want to come back to the class the next time. So each day we have to be inspiring them, motivating them. So I work with all my instructors to make sure we never limit ourselves to thinking that we're there to teach technique. We're there to really teach a lifestyle. And, you know, we're all animals in that sense. And if you look at any animal in nature, if it's not immediately having to hunt or foraging for food, most animals just want to sit down and do nothing. And people are the same way. So we've got to first motivate them to want to come in and try a class, then motivate them to want to join, and then the job isn't done then. It's really still, I think, just starting is motivating them to continually stay in that quest for excellence. It doesn't matter what style you're teaching. The style is secondary. It's really, are you teaching them to cultivate a philosophy of constant self-improvement and really making it something that's a lifelong endeavor?
You bet, you bet. Now, you're basically in your school, you have how many different unique programs that you run right now?
Well, we have our most popular program is the Adult Tai Chi program. And we have the Adult Shaolin classes. We then have a competition team, which also includes the Swai Jiao grappling classes. And then our children's program is Shaolin as well. And in our Shaolin classes, we also do Parker system Kempo. So we do Shaolin / Kempo in our Kung Fu program.
You bet, you bet.
And we're about two-thirds adults, one-third children.
Okay, okay. About how many adults do you have active now in the Tai Chi program?
It's about 200.
Okay, okay. And I think I'd be remiss. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, almost all of our adult Kung Fu students also do the Tai Chi, because the Tai Chi really helps them with the Kung Fu. Conversely, we have probably 75 Tai Chi students who are only looking for health and well-being. They don't really have an interest in the self-defense.
I've got you. I've got you. About what's your median age for the Tai Chi students?
Tai Chi, probably the median age is about 45. Tends to be students from their 30s through their 60s and 70s.
Well, and certainly a nice thing about that target market is you have a very stable, from a standpoint of socioeconomic background, income, life, you know, life situation, much more so than sometimes the younger adults. Is that a fair assessment?
Very fair. We purposely try to target people who are a little more professionals, a little more settled, and can afford to do the classes. But Charlotte's not a huge city, but it's, I think, within the top 20 of population. And so we just find, there's a pretty good demand for things like stress reduction and just general fitness. And I would say the demographics of our student body for the Tai Chi, excuse me, in particular, it's a lot of bankers, IT people, and people working in various professional jobs.
Good, good. And what I was going to say before is I'd be remiss in not pointing out, I mean, you now have really a beautiful campus that you've built for your school. And the school's been open for about 15 years. How did it start? Tell us the evolution of your physical facility a little bit. Where did you start, and when did you end up with this beautiful facility that you have now?
Okay. Well, my wife and I moved down from New York to Charlotte 18 years ago, and I started just teaching one or two people in a local park, and then the next thing we knew, within a year or two, we had 30 or 40 or 50 people coming to the park, and it just made sense then to rent some space. I really had no intention of opening a school. It wasn't a career choice. It was just sort of the demand was there. So we rented space at a strip mall, like many people start off, and we were just fortunate. Within a year or two, we had a couple hundred students. And when our lease was up after 5 years, we got a Small Business Administration loan, and were able to purchase. We bought 12 acres and built a 10,000-square-foot school. So it's a beautiful school on 12 wooded acres in the city of Charlotte. So that's 10 years ago now, and it's done well, and we're just holding steady with that.
And so you've been in that facility for about 10 years.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. That's fabulous. And again, it's hard to describe verbally, but having seen the pictures, haven't had the opportunity to be there personally yet, but it's just a beautiful facility and just an incredible opportunity. And you know, certainly not everybody needs to have that, but if it's something that's a goal in mind for yourself, I know a couple other friends of mine, Buzz Durkin for one, is really creating that ultimate environment and facility and situation is really nice, if that's certainly one of your goals.
Address, you know, from a business perspective, it doesn't make sense to have too much square footage. And I know you work with a lot of multi-school owners. clearly, you know, there's some disadvantages to overbuilding. But in our case, we originally opened and it had a tea house and a gift shop, so we needed the space for all of that. As our classes grew, we phased that out and converted all that space to studio training area. So we have more space than we need. It's a luxury that's nice to have, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it for somebody starting out.
Yeah, well, and a fair way to say it, too, would be is it's not necessary to run the kind
Correct.
Of active count that you're running. It's not necessary to maximize profitability. On the other hand, if in my case over the years, I was interested in having multiple locations, not necessarily having one place that to me personally felt like home. But as a single school operator, sometimes that's a really nice thing to have. Is the place where you can have all the things you've dreamed of and have the facility that ultimately is the ultimate support mechanism for the students. And there's certainly nothing wrong with it. From a standpoint of having purchased the facility, how do you feel like that's worked out? Long-term, is the property and the building going to be have been a good investment as opposed to leasing?
Oh, absolutely. We're paying about the same per month that we paid for renting. Our former school at the strip mall was about 4,000 square feet. Now we have 10,000 square feet that we're paying just maybe a hair more each month. But the nice thing is after 15 years, it's paid off, so you have that equity that you otherwise wouldn't have. So, you know, we all have to think about what happens after teaching martial arts. And in my case, I hope to turn the school over to my son, George, who's been an instructor with me for 15 years. But it is certainly to anybody's advantage to be putting money in the bank in equity versus paying it to a landlord.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are ups and downs in the real estate market, but the nice thing is if you find the perfect location, the perfect property, you know that you're now locked in and not going to be relocated by a landlord who has other plans for you. And especially if you buy at the right time, and certainly right now would be the right time. I would think 10 years ago was. Maybe 3 years ago wasn't. But if you buy at the right time, you're going to have a lot of equity appreciation as well. I've done it a time or two and then turned around and sold them for $200,000, $250,000 in improved equity. And that's not a bad
sure.
deal either when the market's changed.
If you're in it for the long haul, it's just one last point.
Yeah,
even if you had bought it at the worst time, if you had bought it three years ago, and you lost 30%, over the course of a 15-year mortgage, you're still coming out way ahead versus you were paying it to rent. So you can't lose on it as long as you're able to pay your mortgage every month.
Yeah, maybe rephrase what you said. If the school was there for 30 years and you paid a comparable amount of mortgage to rent for 15
yep.
years, now from then on you have only maintenance and property taxes. You don't have a lease payment anymore, and it certainly helps in cash flow long term. But now you have a big equity stake, as opposed to the landlord having a big equity stake. So I think you're exactly right. If you're doing it as the business facility long term, almost up market, down market, trying to predict whatever, you're still going to be further ahead. If you're doing it for speculation, that's a whole different scenario. That's a very, very good point. Let's go back to the Tai Chi program. What kind of retention are you running with that on a monthly dropout rate and so forth? How does that look?
Well, our school retention rate is about averages between 3.5% to 4% per month. So it's not
okay.
perfect. I know some people get it down to 2%, and I admire those who can do that. We tend to average 3.5% to 4%. And to be honest, I haven't tracked, I probably should, but just haven't separated it out from program to program. I've just tracked comparing adults versus kids. We tend to have, for whatever reasons, about the same retention rate with our adult programs and kids programs, even though they're totally different animals and we teach them differently. But we don't have any wild swings between the adults and kids. But as far as breaking down the adults between the Kung Fu program and the Tai Chi program, I don't have those statistics.
Okay, sure. You know, looking at the industry on a macro level, is kids, say, 5 to 12 years old, adults 40 and up, both are pretty good markets where you have some stability in long term. Where we see the challenges is the 18 to 30-year-old market. And the more it tends towards being a fitness center environment as opposed to a school environment, the worse it gets. I was talking yesterday, Eric, to Paul Miller, who you know well now.
Yep.
And this year he said, which, you know, it's such a dramatic number, I have trouble believing it, but he's got it documented. He said with what we've been working on, he's gone from 15% per month attrition, which, of course, we know is abysmal, to half a percent a month.
Wow.
And what usually the best I hear is in the 1% to 2% range. And as you know, most of the schools that we work with at a high level that are doing a very, very good job are floating in the 3% to 4% range about the same place you are. Probably the industry norm is in the 8% to 10% a month range. So it's, again, useful to have those benchmarks. It's always one of those things that, and for anybody who doesn't understand the number we're talking about, it's if you take your complete total active student base, so let's say we have 300 active training students, and look at how many drop out on average each month, we're looking at the percentage of the total versus dropout. So at 300 active, if you drop out 30 a month, that's 10%. If you drop out 15 a month, that's 5%. If you drop out 4% or 12 a month, that's 4%. So, and that's probably about your number you need in the range of...
Yeah, that's right where we are, because we average about 300 students and fluctuate, but it's typically we lose about 10 to 12 per month.
Yeah, so you need 10 to 12 per month to be at break even. Anything above that, you're growing. Anything below that, you're shrinking. And
that's right.
You've done a very good job of having a very strong average student value. On an average revenue per month, what's the average student worth to you now? It's around $210, $220. Is that right?
Yeah, it tends to be right around just above $200. We adopted your method of when two people pay, the rest of the family's free. So we do have several students families where they have free members. So that brings the average down a little bit, but it hovers just above $200. For our paying students, it's probably up around 275 or so. But because we have the non-paying students, that brings it down.
Yeah. Well, that's an important number. So 300 active students, that means about $750,000 a year in that facility. And, of course, we're actually working to get that to $1 million and probably on track for that next year. You mentioned that idea. I always like to give credit where it's due. That was one that Master Bill Clark talked me into, and took me for a while. Took me a while to come to grips with it. But what I have found is, and I'm sure you find the same thing, the value of having mom and dad, sister and brother, the value of having a family trained together so far offsets any concern that I have about maybe a little diminished revenue on families of 3 and 4. That it works out much, much better, from my perspective anyway.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't even know if you're losing, because it's not that easy, or at least we haven't had great luck signing up a third, fourth, fifth person anyway, because when a family starts suddenly paying $600, $700, $800 a month, not many families are ready to do that initially. Everybody's happy to pay due and get the rest free. So I don't think you're coming out too far behind, if at all.
Well, that's a good point. And where you'd be coming out behind is if you're charging $100 a month for lessons. But as you start to push up the tuition, and where I came to be a believer in it, is the only problem we had as we kept escalating tuition over the years was in those families of 3, 4, and 5. You know, 'cause now if you're doing an enrollment conference, asking, as you said, for $600, $700, $800 a month, is that's where it gets to be a little rugged. But if you're capping it at two people paying full price, then you keep pushing the tuition level, because you don't get as much blowback or pushback on the single and doubles.
But, right, and then, of course, in the upgrade process, moving them into mastery programs and so forth, then the same family might very well be happy to pay $700-$900 a month or more even, but that's after they've seen the value. So I think for the initial student coming in, two paying and the rest free works well.
Absolutely. So let's stay on the Tai Chi program. What's your tuition structure look like for that program?
The basic initial program is a 12-month program at $227 per month. And then the upgrade program or mastery program is $327 per month.
And
that's a 36-month program.
For some people listening to that, that seems like an awful lot of money. In fact, I think some school owners, when they add something like a Tai Chi program, they go to a lot lower price point than everything else they're doing.
Yep.
What's your experience been on the relationship between student engagement and the ability to have a high conversion rate and the price point? How's your experience been on that?
Well, I think if I go back to when we opened 15 years ago, if I had tried to price much higher, we didn't have the quality of the program. I think our martial arts program, I feel, is very strong, but we didn't understand anything about student services and really creating an environment that is conducive to students reaching a high level of skill. Those are things that have evolved, learning from many sources, including through NATMA and with you, that have helped. So I think if you're going to try to charge premium prices, you really do have to have a premium program. It's a given that we need to be teaching great martial arts. So whatever your lineage and style, if you don't consider yourself to be towards the top or at the top, you need to work on that first, I think. But once that's in place, then you need to work on bringing the same quality to the school system, structure, environment, so that a student really feels like they want to be part of the family, so they're willing to pay more because they really feel like they're getting more for what they're paying.
Absolutely. And let's not skip over the point too quickly. I think we very clearly see that it's very difficult to make a good living charging, say, less than $150 a month. On the other hand, is some people hear the message that we're talking about and think that we're only about charging more and more money for lessons. But the truth is the right sequence is to be more and more sincere in your interaction with students, to go from being focused on technical to focused on developmental, and then to get just really good at student service. Let's talk about what student service means from your perspective, as contrasted with just the mechanical components of the curriculum.
Okay, as I see it, the mechanical components, that's what our instructors are teaching, the front kicks and basics and grappling and so forth. And so you have to have solid skills there. And I think even beginners can distinguish between weak skills or solid skills. So that's a given that has to be solid. But then the things that are what I view as the student services, everything from the monthly activities such as roundtable discussions and monthly lectures and online lectures and reading resources and competition teams and extra training environment and private lessons included. Those are all the extras that just make a much stronger training environment. It's like a college scenario. You have your college class, but then if you also have a media center and tutoring facilities and all those things, those are all things that really augment and complement what you're doing in just your basic classes. So thinking in those terms, and then also just the everything from cleanliness to friendliness. We always just use the term cleanliness and friendliness. And in our staff meetings week after week, we're looking at where are we dropping the ball, how can we wow the student more, are we just paying attention to the students and neglecting their families and so forth. So we're always trying to think in terms of the, people come in, they have harried, stressed lives. We're sort of like their little oasis. What else can we do? Making sure the green tea is always ready and hot for the parents to enjoy, making sure there's free Wi-Fi is always working. So there's anything and everything we can think of. So the entire experience, people feel like we're looking out for them and we want them to be happy there.
Let's not skip over that. If you were going to go through 10 or 20 things that you focus on every week to make sure people have a dramatically positive experience in your school? What are some of those things? Because it probably would surprise a lot of people listening just how deeply you go into to focusing on that.
Well, just off the top of my head, one part-time staff member, she's responsible for from the parking lot to the front counter. Everything has to be immaculate, cleaned, all the landscaping in perfect shape. So she spends a few minutes every day on that. Everything, you know, windows and doors, glass being cleaned daily, everything being vacuumed, and we have quarterly cleanup days where we do all that. So from just a visual perspective, I mean, we have a nice facility, but there's just like if you go into a nice hotel, but it's not maintained well, that's a real turnoff. So we're always looking at that. Then our front counter person is supposed to learn every student and parent's name and greet them by name, always be conversing. We tend to naturally have the people we would be friends with outside of the school, but we try to make sure that those people who might not be our personal friend, are we treating them in as friendly and personable a nature as anybody else so that everybody feels like they're part of the family? We make sure when people miss class, they're getting emails and phone calls. When a new student joins, we send them welcoming gifts, books on Tai Chi and resources and things like that. So it's a long list that I can't think of everything now, but you know, small details collectively can make a big impact.
Well, absolutely. And for those who have a fairly big staff, and to some extent we all have a big staff, even a single school operator, because your higher level students and those who are volunteer support all fit into that category, it's so important to be modeling that level of sincerity. And Eric, you're not only a little reserved, but perhaps a little modest. Is what I see is that you and your staff model such a sincere interest in each individual you come in contact with, and are far from trying to put yourself up on a pedestal, but are very focused on really having each person that comes within your environment feel like they're part of the family. And it's something that, again, in our industry, a lot of martial artists are competitors and perhaps have a little bit of ego. And if we can reshift that focus on the individual student and maintain our perspective of us as educators, not as somebody to be emulated or revered, it's such a dramatic difference. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And you're right. I had sort of a mixed upbringing in that I was both competing heavily in my younger years, but I also, day one, had an interest in education. Through teaching public school and working with McGraw-Hill and other big corporations in their education departments, it was really ingrained in me that people have different learning styles, and people, you know, the objective is to make sure every single student is making progress relative to his or her capacity. And I think too often as instructors, if we're not careful, we can focus on ourselves and lose the focus on the student. And really, like a good coach, I think it was Bill Parcells said the only person who should be getting fat around here is me. As a coach, it's okay to not be the best competitor to a certain degree, but it's not okay to not have your student reach his or her fullest potential. So I believe, you know, like you said, we model it, so we should be in great shape and we should be able to do the arts better than any of our students. But if we get too caught up in thinking in those terms, then it becomes about ourselves again instead of about the student.
Yeah, and ultimately it should be our goal is to have every student with the underlying capacity to be better than we ever were. And the great teachers I've experienced, whether it be June Rhee or Jeff Smith or a series of others, that was really always their focus, was not to feel like they were, you know, the best that had ever lived or whatnot. And in both cases, they were at the very pinnacle. But their mission was to have every student, if they had the capacity, to be better than they were in whatever area that student was capable of. And of course, we know a lot of our students, them achieving at a high level of athleticism isn't necessarily their mission, but to let them achieve their fullest potential in every way is the benchmark here. On the marketing and sales side, we haven't talked much about that now. So obviously, okay, you have a very strong program, and you're bringing in 15 to 20 new students a month on a pretty regular basis. And one of the things we're working on is trying to pump that up a little bit. But what has been effective for you in reaching the adult market, especially for the Tai Chi program? What are some things that you've tried that they perhaps used to work that aren't working now, and some things that you've tried that are working pretty consistently?
Well, before the Great Recession hit in 2008, our main sources were local media, the citywide newspaper, some of the alternative entertainment, free pickup newspapers. We did a lot of advertising in those, and they did very well. After the recession, we still do those things, but we get about a 30 to 40% response compared to what we used to. So we've had to focus much more heavily on the internet. So Google pay-per-click and internet is now our number one source of new students. Number two is people just driving by. We do have an attractive building on a main highway, so we do get a lot of just drive-by traffic. Number three now is referrals or word of mouth. So even though we continue to spend several thousand dollars a month on advertising, those aspects are secondary now to the word of mouth, website, and drive-by.
So let's start at the number three. What are some things that you do with the adults to facilitate referrals, to make it easier for them to bring their friends and family and to make them more comfortable with it?
Well, we've had for several years a formal referral program where you refer three people, you get $1,000 credit and so forth. And to be quite frank, we've never had great results with it. And interestingly, I've forgotten the name of the book, but you sent me a book a month or two back on word of mouth referrals. Do you remember the title by chance?
Yeah, no, I should. I've got about five copies still sitting around. But that's a very good book.
So I read through it quickly, and one point that was brought up in it is you can't buy referrals, and that really struck me, and it made me realize anytime we've tried formal referral things with, you know, gift cards or monetary rewards and so forth, it's never done as well as just when people are happy with the program, they just want to go tell their friends. So we're moving back to just letting it be sort of more organic, just keep teaching great classes and giving great service and let it just spontaneously happen. Simply, and other people might have more formal things that do work better, but ours have never worked as well as just trying to offer the best program possible and just allow the natural referrals to come.
Yeah. Well, let's not skip over that too quickly. Is from the standpoint, number one, of you can't buy referrals, is I think that's a very important point, because what you hear almost universally is people talking about you get a certain number of karate bucks, every friend you bring in for an intro, you get $100, or you get $100 karate bucks, or we're going to have a drawing for a cruise, or we're going to give away a rollerboard or something. And see, I think it's okay to spend a lot of money on people who are giving you referrals, but it's got to be a surprise gift, not something that they think that they're bringing their friend in so they can get. I heard it described very well one time that it's much easier. I forget who it was. It may have been J. Abraham or Dan Kennedy, but they said that it's much easier to get the person who has referred one person to refer now 2, 3, 4, and 5, than to get the person who hasn't referred anybody to refer the first person. And it sort of comes back to the 80-20 rule, where a small portion of your students are both gregarious or have a big range of influence or are just so engaged and excited about what you do that they're trying to drag all their friends down. And if Susie, who's 47 years old, training in your Tai Chi class, brings a couple of her friends and enrolls a big flower basket or a dinner certificate as a surprise mail to her home, you know, preferably by FedEx, is a lot more effective than saying to her up front, how would you like to get an extra $1,000 or how would you like to get, you know, your tuition free for life. And I remember even going back to, God, it must have been 1978, I was training at a Taekwondo Nautilus Center, and he was always having, you know, gifts and so forth, referrals. And I figured out at one time I had probably given him more referrals than anybody else in the facility, just a huge number. And it was always when he wasn't doing any kind of contest, because it kind of annoyed me with the idea that I was going to, like, bring a friend down to something I thought was useful for him in order to have a reward for me. And I think most people ultimately have that sense. I'm a DirecTV subscriber, and they have all these different ads for you get a $500 thing or you get a $100 thing for bringing your friend. But we all ultimately bring our friends only to things that we think are a good deal for them. And so it's a very good point. Let's go to, you know, there's not perhaps a lot that people can do from a standpoint of mimicking the facility that you have, although have you done any interesting things, balloon on the roof or signage on offers or anything? I mean, obviously you have a beautiful facility to begin with, and it's dramatic if you drive by. But have you done anything extra to facilitate that, or is it just such a dramatic that people come in?
Well, the only thing we do is when we have events going on, like we just had a Tai Chi festival, we do that every year. We do a Chinese New Year's festival. We do put out banners and flyers and things by the road when those things are going on. And seasonally, we'll put out a sign that says, you know, back to school special, those kind of things. So, yeah, we're always trying to think of that. But sort of just banner signs or street signs, nothing special now.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to what's number one now, the internet. And that book is called Word of Mouth Marketing, How Smart Companies Get People Talking by Andy Cernovitz with Guy Kawasaki, chief evangelist for the original Mac development team. Seth Godin, who's well known, who came out of Yahoo. But Word of Mouth Marketing by Andy Cernovitz is very good. That's the one I sent you. And the other one is also Word of Mouth Marketing by Jerry Wilson is a good book. But it's a very good way to think about it. But I think that first starting point is you can't, in very rare cases, you can't buy somebody to bring their friends something they don't think is going to be great for them.
I think only maybe if you have a program of lesser quality, you might superficially, to a certain degree, bribe people to do things, but it's not going to last, and you can't sustain it, I don't think.
Yeah. But on the other hand, is showing appreciation helps to reinforce the behavior, and
absolutely.
So the more you show appreciation, I think the better off you are. And the other thing is with several schools that I know, Steele Valley was one of the masters of this, is having events and activity that people feel comfortable bringing their friends to. Because your students are never going to be good at selling martial arts. Frankly, most of our staff aren't particularly good at selling martial arts. But they are going to be, you know, if there's an event, a fair, an activity, that they feel comfortable inviting their friends to, it makes it an easy transition for them to bring their friends down. But let's go back to internet. You now have that as the number one source. And from the standpoint of and by the way, your website is what, peacefuldragon.com or the peaceful?
Thepeacefuldragon.com.
Thepeacefuldragon.com. But from a standpoint of online traffic, is Google pay-per-click number one, or what's driving most of your traffic online?
Well, as you know, it's tough to get people to really, sometimes they're not even clear in their own mind whether they saw it organically or it was a Google ad. Some people really can't even distinguish the difference. So when you ask, we do track and certainly ask students how they learned about us, but you know, just using Google Analytics the best we can, we think we're getting a little more traffic from the organic. I have a guy who works on search engine optimization, trying to keep us up at the top of the page. We get a little more hits from that than from the pay-per-click ads, but we're getting them from both, so we keep the pay-per-click ads. I think we budget maybe around $600 a month to pay-per-click.
And the nice thing about pay-per-click is, again, there's a whole science in buying keywords, and probably the two quick things we can both tell people is, piece of science number one is to buy a lot of keywords, not one or two. And number two is to really be careful about it, the exclusionary keywords, so that when the next UFC is on, you're not getting a 500 or 1,000 clicks on people who want the stats on the fighters or something like that. But the nice thing is you can set aside a fairly small amount of money and you're only paying for results, not for placement. And compared to paying $1,000 for a newspaper ad, putting a top end of $500, $600, $700, $800 a month on pay-per-click, you're guaranteed you're going to get traffic. The other thing you said is it's hard to tell, which is a reasonable thing to say, but between the organic listings and pay-per-click. And the other thing we know is if you're in the top of the organic listings and you're number one in pay-per-click, the organic does better because people default to the search results, not to what they know now is paid advertising. However, it's a shame to come up at the top of the organic listings and let somebody else be at the top of pay-per-click, given how cheap it is to be on the top of pay-per-click as well for most of us.
And I think one thing I would just like to add that I think is important, I think you know me well enough now over the years, I'm about as non-technical a person as you can find because I just don't have an interest in it. So I try to make sure that I just learn enough to know what needs to be done, but I would never waste any time trying to go do it. Somebody like Toby or yourself who have the skill to do it. I know I could figure it out, but there's so many other things I could do better. So I think it's a good investment. You know, don't get scared by the fact that you might not be technically astute, but spend a little bit of money rather than put another ad in the paper, put that $500 to pay somebody to boost your search engine optimization or set up your Google accounts. And, you know, there's so many people now who do it really well and they're not that expensive that it's a no-brainer that you need to do it, but you don't need to do it yourself.
Well, that's true. And it is one of those things, by the way, that we're doing a series of webinars and so forth for everybody, so we don't need to get into it too deeply. But it's one of those things that you can outsource internationally as well now. There's so many resources that we have a firm in the Philippines and a firm in India, I believe, that does it. And I guess I would correct one thing. I'm always the guy who when we were doing a video production, I went and took a week and a half of classes from Sony. And the gentleman teaching the class looked at me kind of funny, and he said, "Why are you here? You're never actually going to do any of this stuff yourself." I said, "Well, before I hire somebody to do it, I want to understand, you know, what's good, what's bad, what can be done." So I'm always the systems guy. I don't have the patience for actually touching the keys and going in and doing the coding. But I will go and learn how it all works first so that when I hand it off to somebody, I know whether they're doing a good job or a bad job, or whether they tell me something can't be done, whether they're right or wrong. But I'm not particularly I'm capable but not patient. And so I don't have a coder's or a programmer's set on me for that reason.
Yep.
You're exactly right. Is one of the things I have seen, though, is some schools who now they get really enamored of the online world, and they spend a ton of time blogging, creating new websites, creating YouTube videos, and you do have to keep it in perspective. In your case, you're driving number one traffic from internet, probably paying $500 a month for search engine optimization, $600 a month for pay-per-click. Know enough to know what to hand off to somebody, but probably are engaged, what, maybe an hour a month of your own time on this? Is that a fair?
Yeah. My background, I'm a decent copywriter, so I write all the copy, but I then turn it over to the technical guys for everything.
Yeah, so you know, maybe worst case an hour a week. And I've seen a lot of people get so enamored of this that they'll do $8, $10 an hour labor just because it's fun. And it's not benefiting their outcomes very well. Well,
yeah, I think one thing you've often said, like even with your martial arts, if kickboxing or rolling around is your hobby, go to it all you want, but don't mix it up with managing the school. If technical geekdom computer stuff is your hobby, you know, go for it, but you know, it's not the most efficient way to manage your school if somebody else could do it.
Yeah, and don't think of the time that you're spending there as legitimate business time that you should be doing in the school if you can hire somebody for half or a quarter of what you should be making it out. Hey, we're going to run out of time here pretty quickly, Eric, but you know, you've been involved with Inner Circle for quite a while, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a lot of the members who hear this, and they've been hearing about Inner Circle and Peak Performers for some reason or another, you know, have some questions or some hesitancy. What would you tell them about the experience, what it's all about, what the other people are like, just to kind of clarify their thinking on that? What's your experience, and what might they want to think about with that?
Well, clearly for us, it's been useful. I've learned a lot from both you and Toby and your staff at NAPMA, but I also learn a lot from the other school owners who are, as we said, it makes no difference what style you're doing, Taekwondo, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The style's incidental, but the systems for good customer service, good sales and marketing, curriculum development, making sure your students are within the context of your traditions, you know, fulfilling their potential. We certainly, you know, there's 20 people or 10 people in a room all doing the same thing. We get a much more vibrant and robust plate of ideas to work from. So I really found that to be valuable. And also, on a day-to-day basis, sometimes the little things, you know, we're in our own vacuum at our own school. We don't know. What do you do when a parent's unhappy and they want a refund? These kind of questions, you know, we can think off the top of our head, but it's nice to know, well, what are other quality schools doing and what's working there and how do you still maintain good relationships? So it's nice to have a lot of people to discuss even some of the more detailed or seemingly mundane things as well as the big picture things like your marketing and curriculum. So I've found it to be really useful and valuable. And the biggest thing I could say, what I've observed over the, I think it's 3 years now that I've been in the Inner Circle and I've been with NAPMA now since we opened our school, the only people who don't get anything out of it are people who want magic pills but don't want to go work hard to implement. But if you're motivated to work hard for your students and for your school, if you're actually willing to go do what you learn how to do, you can't go wrong. If you think it's going to be just you get ideas and that changes things, then it's not going to work. But if you get the ideas and then go implement, then it's really effective.
You bet. And one of the things you said that I might reemphasize is I think the synergy among people who are, I mean, we have everything from predominantly adult men doing Muay Thai to predominantly fitness-oriented environments with cardio, hardcore MMA, in your case, an emphasis on adults doing Tai Chi to Jonathan Metcalf and a lot of others who are predominantly doing character development for kids and families or transported after school care. And I always feel like the synergy between those various backgrounds and different approaches is really a key, as opposed to some people say, well, he's teaching adults Tai Chi, I'm teaching kids, what am I going to learn? I don't think there's been anything in the conversation that's not just as valuable in what we've had, no matter which audience you're teaching.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, when you mentioned Dan Kennedy, I think one of the reasons so many people are successful with him is not only is it within different styles of martial arts, but he emphasizes different industries, and he's not alone in that, but, you know, a chiropractor, a beauty salon, if we think as martial artists we can't learn from them, we're very mistaken, because there's always things in other industries that we're overlooking that if we can implement. So I think ideas are all over the place, and the more varied, the more ideas we can end up with.
Sure. And again, the nice thing with what we're doing with Peak Performers Inner Circle is then having somebody as a mentor coach who can help focus that into, I think I like to think of it this way, and you're perhaps the best person I've ever seen at having a 37-point to-do list and actually getting all of them done. Where I think most of people in the real world is having three or four things on the to-do list at any one time, and focusing is the thing they need somebody then as a coach to help them narrow in on and to focus on the thing that's going to have the best impact on their students or the best income, direct impact on their bottom line, and not to get bogged down and distracted on other things.
Yeah, well, you know, it's no different. We all grew up doing martial arts. So you can learn your techniques, but if you don't go practice them and implement them, they're never yours. So you have to put the time in.
Exactly. Hey, we've gone a little bit over our time allotment here. We've really gotten some great value from you, Mr. Sparge. I really appreciate it. Any last couple words of wisdom for everybody to really start making a dramatic improvement in their schools?
Well, I just want to thank you and what you've contributed to the industry themselves. Keep doing what you're doing. I think if people are open-minded, realize that, you know, you don't have to have profit as your primary motive, but if you can bring good business and customer service systems into your school, your students are going to be better off for it, and you'll be better off for it. So it's all good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes back to Zig Ziglar's famous quote, you can have everything in life you want if you help enough other people get what they want. You've got to have fabulous quality of customer and student service. Then you've got to have enough of them to have that kind of critical mass in the school, and ultimately profits follow, they don't lead. So that's exactly right. Well, thank you, sir, for your time. And,
thank you.
I'll get a commitment from you that we'll do a little follow-up, because we've barely scratched the surface and you have so much to contribute.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.